ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Has Pauline Hanson hit a polling ceiling? The One Nation leader's likability dropped by 11 points, while support for the minor party fell by 3%, as voters rejected some of One Nation's key policies. And the coalition could stand to benefit, with opposition leader Angus Taylor muscling up and offering his strongest rebuke of the minor party yet. Meanwhile, Labor is riding high after a week of successful diplomacy. But as the government works through its second tranche of budget legislation, a series of spot fires are building for Treasurer Jim Chalmers. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Claire Armstrong.
And happy Monday, happy poll day to you as well, Claire. It's like we're always talking polls on Monday. And we've got a doozy to talk about, don't we?
Yeah, I feel excited subbing in for Greber on a Monday. I'm, you know, getting to have the poll chat that I normally listen to you guys talking about.
It is. Can I say all days are special? But Monday is a special, special day for setting the agenda for the week. It really is. And there's nothing like the polls and what they say about where things are at. So usual caveats, polls, just an indication. They're just a survey, but they do tell you something about the mood, which is why I always think they're worth talking about. They certainly make politicians frame their responses. So that also matters because poll results are about how politicians see their performance as well. I just want to mention that part because it's key. So it was the Resolve poll in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and it found One Nation support slipped by 3%. Now it's 26% support. Still high. Let's not pretend that's not a remarkable result. It still is, but it shows that it's on a downward trajectory rather than still building. And voters seem to be rejecting some of the key policies which Pauline Hanson has been forced in some ways to talk about and others that she's chosen to talk about. Claire, voters didn't really turn up for Labor though necessarily, right?
Not on these numbers. And as we like to repeat ad nauseum in journalism, the trend is your friend. And it's very early to be diagnosing even trends at this point. But I think picking up on what you said at the start about, you know, have One Nation reached their ceiling? I think we were always going to find out, you know, the strength of this support for One Nation in two phases. The first was going to be establishing what the ceiling is. And I think the trend across all the published polls we've seen for the last few weeks is indicating we've probably seen that the ceiling for One Nation on primary is around that sort of 30% mark. What we don't know yet is the floor. The floor used to be single digits, under 10%, pretty well consistently across the country since Pauline Hanson came back into Parliament a decade ago. I think we will have a new floor. I think we're probably months away from getting an understanding of what that is. But what we're seeing now is these secondary trends of obviously a lot of vote came off the coalition and went to One Nation. First early shoot signs of that vote coming back across to the coalition. The voters didn't turn to Labor, but I think that can partly be explained potentially by the fact that there wasn't comparatively as many voters leaving Labor to go to One Nation. There were still voters leaving, but you would expect as that vote comes off One Nation's ceiling that more of it would flow back to the coalition.
Yeah, that's right, because the fundamental story was still that it was hurting the coalition much more than Labor, although, of course, it became a bit more complex as they gained more and more support, because, of course, then you start taking from the centre as well, not just right-leaning voters. Look, I think it's really interesting that the coalition is the beneficiary of this. This is so, can I say, in the way that politics works, such a relief for Angus Taylor and his office. Just some like little nugget of keep going, because I think it's been a very hard period for him to sort of gain any traction, and this is just something. In fact, I've had some coalition people, not even fans of Angus Taylor's, but saying, good, you know, we're muscling up to One Nation, we're getting somewhere, let's keep going. That's the vibe, isn't it?
Yes, and isn't it interesting that we've had this result following what was really, you know, Angus Taylor's first true crack at One Nation, and starting to lay out, as he did in a speech at the end of last week, what it is voters are potentially signing themselves up for if they support and continue to support One Nation. I think, you know, it's probably a bit too early to suppose that that in and of itself is what's explaining this trend. I think when you see the way that Labor, I think quite effectively, Tanya Plibersek, for example, really honing in on the idea that paid parental leave was under threat in a Pauline Hanson-run government or supported government. Some of the stuff around workers' rights has obviously been getting traction. And I think the fact that we've now seen Pauline Hanson have about four cracks at trying to explain her version of a monoculture, each getting closer and closer to what is the textbook definition of multiculturalism, kind of says that there's a few things going into this result, but for whatever reason, it's drawing people back to the coalition, which I think is a bit of a stay of political execution, if I can be that blunt, for Angus Taylor, because the writing had really started to be on the wall for his leadership, I think.
I think you can be that blunt. That's the point of this podcast. And I think you are absolutely correct. His leadership was under enormous pressure. This just gives him a bit of breathing room. It doesn't solve all his problems. This is still not a poll result that is going to deliver the coalition the kind of results it needs. And so they still have very deep-rooted issues, and they all know that. But at least it gives him reprieve. And sometimes as a leader dealing in it with a very difficult set of circumstances, which he's inherited as well, they're not all of his making, right? That's not fair. That you do just need a bit of breathing room, and he's got a little bit of breathing room now to kind of also lock in to a strategy that he seems to be now finally, and I think it's taken too long, but he's settling on. And that's, you know, it all kind of culminated at the end of last week where he gave a speech to the Sydney Institute, and he said One Nation would bring the Australians, the economy, an eternity of pain. He just didn't mince his words. He went hard after One Nation on their economic credentials. So he did two things by doing that, leaning in on the coalition's traditional advantage, which it still holds broadly, which is that it is a better manager of the economy. Again, I always say this because people misinterpret. That is not my view. That is what the public often says. Okay. I'm not saying it's not my view either. I'm saying that is the vibe of the thing, and that is a thing that is an advantage for them. I know that because Labor people say it is to me, right? Like, yes, it is an advantage for the coalition. He's leaning into it, but he's using it to dismantle One Nation. Now, until late last week, he was absolutely timid about going after Pauline Hanson.
His door was open to her. He was ready to work with her in defeating Labor and Labor's taxes, which was an astonishing kind of path to go down. I think what's really interesting, and I'm not going to give Angus Taylor credit for this because I don't think he could have quite seen it coming, but he has had this moment of distancing himself in the clearest possible way so far in his leadership from Pauline Hanson ahead of what I expect is going to be a very rough week for Pauline Hanson. And I say this for a couple of reasons. We know her podcast interview with Tommy Robinson, the far right, you know, convicted on many counts involving assault, involving defamation, fraud, too far right for Nigel Farage of the UK Reform Party. She has appeared on his podcast. We know she did a street walk in London over the weekend, remarking upon how she wouldn't even recognise this as England. And we know that there is now a feature, a spotlight via Channel 7 feature coming on her at the end of the week. And if the reporting by Jacko and the Oz is to be believed, there was a bit of an altercation or quite a strong interview between Liam Bartlett, Tommy Robinson and Pauline Hanson. I think this is going to be a week of some pretty intense scrutiny, the likes of which she probably hasn't had today. And for Angus to have distanced himself from her at that moment, I think will prove very fortuitous.
Very fortuitous. Timing is everything. I think you're right. There are a few difficult moments coming up for her in the week ahead. But I suppose this also demonstrates a kind of cliche that I'll pull out of my hat, that sunshine is the best disinfectant, right? And so one of the things that I think has happened since Pauline Hanson and One Nation has been going up in the polls is that journalists have increasingly made, I think, the correct decision, which is if they are really going to become a party of government, they must be subjected to the kind of scrutiny you give to any party of government, which is, you know, repeated questions about your strategy, how you will pay for it, all of that. So that, thankfully, Pauline Hanson actually assisted in that by giving herself the platform of the National Press Club. She said yes to that. She didn't have to. She did it. I bet she regrets it, by the way. I suspect you won't see it happening again. Do you agree with me?
I think
that's so. That's just a punt, by the way.
I should also say, when I think she's having a bad, there's a high risk of a bad week coming for her. I mean, in the minds of sort of mainstream political Australia, there is obviously absolutely a core base that are really responding, and that she's quite used to having respond positively to the types of things she's been saying and doing. It's just she's fallen back into that at a time when the party actually has been trying to have more of a mainstream appeal to start to talk about being conceived of as a potential party of government, if not opposition.
Now, we have just assessed that we believe, you know, based on talking to a lot of people, as we both do, and seeing where things are going, that Angus Taylor needed to sort of take on some of One Nation's ideas, policies, differentiate. I mean, I think it's smart politics, but not everyone agrees with that. Inside of the coalition, we've got people like Alex Antic, who has already said he does not think it's a good idea that Angus Taylor take this approach. That does show, doesn't it, Claire, that it's not actually an easy path for Angus Taylor. It's not like he was just on his own kind of holding back because it was his own personal view. He was reflecting a view in his party room, wasn't he?
And not just that, I completely agree, but also there is no proven method of success. Like, we don't know how this story ends, whether you choose the adventure of being oppositional and antagonistic toward One Nation, or if you try and sort of trundle along in that direction and focus all of your energy on Labor. It's objectively the case that the coalition can't return to government until Labor lose government. And so arguably that is the bigger fight that they need to have politically. But if they don't have the base, the resources, the support financially and otherwise, the traction in the community, then they've got nothing to launch off to then mount those fights with Labor. And I sense that that is a realisation that is starting to seep into the party, that even people who were previously maybe at least just unsure, if not reticent, about criticising One Nation directly, have started to realise they're not going to have much of a platform to launch off if they don't stabilise where they are.
Yeah, that's the stop the bleeding view. And originally when Angus Taylor took over as leader, that was actually the whole pitch, stop the bleeding to the right.
But by moving to the right. And now, yes, I think he's pumped the brakes and said, well, we're going to stop for a minute and actually look at what exists to the right of us and start to really question it.
Yeah, and that's kind of a fascinating moment, really. It's repositioning their approach, and it'll be really interesting to see whether, you know, maybe I'm going to say something controversial. Maybe Angus Taylor's been underestimated. You know, let's just wait and see.
Absolutely.
Many people writing him off. Maybe there is a bigger strategy at play here. I think it's way too early to say it's going to work, but way too early. But there is something, we're seeing something germinate here.
Yes. And I think, you know, it does take two to tango as well. And you wrote about this today in your analysis piece. This coincides with quite a few Labor-owned goals as well. And so I think that can't, you know, none of this happens in a vacuum when people are weighing up who they might, you know, a poll question is literally, if there was an election today, who would you support? I think people are weighing up both sides here as well, not just that sort of battle on the right of, or centre-right of politics.
Now let's pivot because Labor, I think, really had a pretty successful week last week. We've talked about it on the pod over the last week, but really, you know, no one, I spoke to coalition people, they think it was a successful week. You know, everyone agrees that the Pacific Blitz was a successful endeavour. Whatever your concerns are, and many are right to have them about the Indian Prime Minister, democracy, the way that he runs India, from an Australian perspective, being able to do deals with India in a very hostile world is good for Australia at an international level. I am not endorsing the Indian Prime Minister's very sometimes anti-democratic approach, right, particularly to scrutiny. So all of this happens. But they did go into the midwinter break, despite feeling good, with key legislation that has to be dealt with down the road. And of course, that's all centred around the growing backlash to the next round of budget tax measures, which they still have to deal with, Claire. Like, it doesn't go away for them. They still have to deal with it, even if the kind of architecture of the tax changes has passed, right?
Absolutely. I think what we'll see over these sort of 5 weeks where Parliament isn't sitting is a bit of a slow burn, and it will become increasingly obvious the closer we get to the return of Parliament where the real issues are for the government, which has acknowledged that there is a lot of work to do. We had the consultation paper on the capital gains tax, what will be sort of a second tranche of legislation there with the carve-outs. This is the issue around startups and other people who deserve exemptions. Consultations for that. Submissions closed last Friday. We're starting to see now some of the business groups and other types of people come forward and ventilate the issues that they've obviously submitted. The government last week also opened up consultation on their next big piece of legislation out of the budget, which is this imposition of a 30% minimum tax on distributions from discretionary trusts, which sounds like a nightmare. But essentially, families, businesses and other use these discretionary trusts to distribute money and assets and income out of them in a way that they can control. That's the discretionary part. The government is arguing that this has long been used as a way to minimise tax because you might opt to give that money to a beneficiary that's in a lower tax bracket than someone else. Income splitting, essentially, is the thing they're really going after here. They've put out a consultation paper. I've done a story today. We'll put it in the line notes. I think what's really interesting is even in that consultation paper, the government is sort of saying, here are some pretty prickly issues in this plan that we have. Would you, the business community, accountants and others, please like to advise us on how we might navigate this? And one of the immediate things that's come up for the couple hundred thousand small businesses that are structured through trusts is the federal government at the moment is putting on the table the offer of rollover assistance. Treasurer Jim Chalmers calls it generous assistance. It essentially will mean they don't get hit with CGT and other tax implications when they move out of a trust into a company, which is what the government kind of wants. But they may still get stung with state stamp duty. And the Commonwealth has no control over that. And what businesses have been saying is, well, we can't even make a decision about whether to restructure because you need to be able to tell us if the West Australian government or the Queensland government are going to whack us on the way through this restructure, which you are trying to force us into, or at least push us toward. So I think we're going to see constant little spot fires like this just popping up for Jim Chalmers, and that any given one will not be that much of an issue. In fact, I'm sure most of this legislation will get through the Senate with the support of the Greens. But it just has this accumulative effect. I think it makes it harder and harder for the government each time they go around and come back to this community and impose more changes on them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a slow burn, right? You want to make sure that it's not, because I'm not saying it is yet, but it doesn't become a death by a thousand cuts. To, you know, where there's kind of growing grievance across this sector, which is influential, and it's sort of a perception in the community about your bona fides on investment and growth and the way that you see all these things. And, you know, in Australia, I think there has always been a broad view that you want aspiration to be at the centre of things still. You want people to be able to have a go, get a go. Do you like that? That's a sort of a have a go, get a go.
What a throwback.
Yeah, I know. I can't help myself. And they just need to be conscious of how they manage it. Let's see. Look, there's another thing that I think is very big, actually. And, of course, it all centres around a very big national project, which is the National Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism, which is currently going on. But something very specific coming out of it is shifting to how to deal with higher education institutions and how they deal with different forms of racism, including, of course, anti-Semitism. The government has announced it'll require higher education institutions to adopt definitions of anti-Semitism, racism, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders discrimination against them as well, and also Islamophobia. Also plans to strengthen the powers of the higher education regulator so it can fully enforce the new rules from January the 1st. But Claire, interesting decision by the government that it will not require a specific definition to be adopted in any of these categories. Now, I think the universities will be pleased about that because the definition, of course, which many have been insisting on for anti-Semitism is incredibly contentious. However you feel about it, it is contentious. That is not contestable. It is a very contentious definition. Government's not forcing the universities to take on the IHRA definition. And that has really annoyed the opposition, right?
Yes. I mean, there's long been a push. It was in the report by the anti-Semitism special envoy, Julian Siegel. Her report a year ago was that she wanted a lot of public institutions to adopt this IHRA definition. You know, the ABC, for whom we are both employees of, has chosen not to adopt that, and has, you know, extensively explained why. I think there will be as many kind of people involved or interested in this who agree with the government not dictating the definitions of all of these types of discrimination as there are who disagree. I think what is important to remember and what is really trying to be achieved here, and this will be the test really for if these standards, this regulation has an effect, is by requiring all of these institutions to have a definition, regardless of where they land, and they're not going to just pull something out of thin air. There is a lot of academia around how to qualify and quantify these terms. It means that people who feel that they have been subjected to that type of discrimination, be it Islamophobia, be it anti-Semitism, will have a benchmark with which they can now argue against that's what they've experienced. And that has been something that has clearly been lacking in institutions like higher education, where this thing is so subjective that you kind of end up just arguing in circles rather than having a standard that now is the benchmark to be held against. You're going to have a beefed up regulator to be able to enforce that. I think that can only be sort of a positive structure. If we get down the line of implementation and find that it does need to be a more cohesive or standardized definition, then I guess that's a can of worms for a future day for whoever's education minister at the time. But this is still progress, and I think that's going to be very interesting to watch. Interestingly as well, some of the other kind of transparency measures that are going in with these standards, things like requiring universities to declare on a sort of public register of some description when they have staff members who work externally or are part of other organisations, what income is coming in, that I think that's all going to be really important to rebuilding trust in a system where there's clearly, from what we've been hearing, even just in this early evidence of the Royal Commission this morning, a real trust deficit.
Yeah, I think it's really well explained. I think, though, this issue around anti-Semitism in universities, so the government's gone ahead and, you know, been very broad and, as we say, hasn't insisted on the definition for the universities, which people like Shadow Education Minister Julian Lisa are pretty angry about. They say university leaders have been weak and spineless over anti-Semitism, and that the definition does need to be imposed. I think the reluctance has always been that definition, and even its architect, the person who actually came up with the definition, has talked to this, can have a chilling effect of not allowing people to even criticise Israel. Now, others will argue, I just want to get this on the record, that actually you can criticise Israel and still adopt this definition. The problem is that not everyone agrees with that. And when there is that disagreement at the centre of something, I think, you know, in definitions, there's a lot of grey and confusion, and that's where we come to this intellectual problem, I think, for imposing something on universities. However, anti-Semitism has been a problem on campuses. Jewish students have told us they don't feel safe on campuses. They've made it very clear, and they've talked about it in testimony about how they feel. And so it is a really deep-rooted problem, I think, Claire, and a really difficult one to deal with, because you don't want to have a chilling effect on free speech, on legitimate criticism of a nation state and its behaviour. But equally, individuals of Jewish faith who are going to university should be able to go and learn without being kind of targeted for who they are, right?
Absolutely. And getting that balance right, like, that's really the whole ball game here. That's the struggle that all these institutions and governments have had. And there's been a lot of criticism that maybe universities have been too focused on not, you know, potentially curbing free speech or expression, and maybe haven't got that balance right. That's been pretty clear in a lot of the evidence that has been being brought forward in submissions to the Royal Commission. I think the final interesting piece here is that these are pieces of work that were set in motion, like some before, some in response to the terror attack at Bondi last year. But there also is potential for whatever this Royal Commission recommends to kind of build on that. And obviously the government did resist establishing a Royal Commission over the summer, and they put a lot of these things in train, looking at the education system, looking at hate speech laws. Some of that ended up passing, some of it is just being implemented and, you know, rolled out now as we hear about. The government's going to get another go around at this, because what if the Royal Commission does recommend that the government go back to these institutions and tell them to adopt a specific definition that is, you know, universal across the institution? So I think, yeah, it's a weird thing that we're sort of having this year now, that because the government wanted to be immediately responsive to what happened at Bondi, there are things that are in train that may actually be superseded in, you know, 7 or 8 months' time by the Royal Commission. We will just have to wait and see.
Claire, just final thought from me on something that I can't believe, but I can believe is unfolding still. Biggest story going on in the world, of course, which is the Strait of Hormuz open? Is the Strait of Hormuz closed?
Oh,
it's so bad, right?
Yeah.
It is so bad. And so I just wanted to note it, because it wasn't that long ago that we were having, you know, a national address by our Prime Minister about this war, its implications for our fuel supply and our supply chains, whether we would fuel ration. I think since that time, the government's done, I think, an exceptionally good job at ensuring that, you know, we have good level of fuel supplies.
And we've diversified.
Yeah. So doing all that good work. But I just think it's worth noting that this is kicking off again. And we are now, I want to get on the record, in a new frame where that Strait of Hormuz appears to me to now being almost permanently weaponized, right, as a space which has massive implications for the world economy and, of course, people's safety in that region. Don't please ever think that I don't think that's of primary concern. Now, I've spoken to senior people in the government saying, well, what's this? And they say, as if anyone knows what's going on. And that is an extraordinary position to be in, to plan when you don't even know.
Yes, it definitely is. I would maybe add the caveat that I don't think Trump wants to be in the war.
No.
But I think he cares more about how it all looks. And if he is perceived to look weak, he will continue to maintain some kind of presence in this war. I don't think he's a passenger entirely on this one. But it is obvious that it is beyond what I don't think we're seeing this resolved anytime soon. I agree with you that we are probably in a permanent ongoing state of at least uncertainty over that incredibly important shipping lane. And what Australia has going for it is essentially that we are lucky enough in many ways to be a wealthy enough country that we have essentially just bought what is going for the rate that it is going at. And we have diversified massively, but it's important to remember that, you know, we have neighbours in the region who have been doing 4-day weeks basically since the war broke out to try and conserve fuel, who are suffering and will continue to suffer as this flows through, you know, parts of the economy like the agricultural sector. Food shortages, this is huge. And the flare-up only adds. And I can't help but wonder what this does, yes, as well, to the domestic agenda here economically, to inflation, to that excise cut that's tapering off.
Yes.
There's a whole big bundle of problems coming down the barrel for the government, I think.
There is, of something that they absolutely can't control, which is so often what happens to governments. Think pandemic, think this. It's
giving
constant.
The pandemic in terms of the uncertainty and the feeling of we've got our head around this. This is what it's going to be. And then, oh no, it's back.
And you get sucked back in, don't you? Yeah, it does. I just the flare up is just so alarming. That's it for Politics Now today. Thank you so much for joining me, Claire.
Thanks for having me.
And tomorrow, Raf Epstein will join me for the latest developments. And if you have a question for us, please send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. We'll try to answer them. We're making a special Question Time episode. So get your questions in. Claire, have yourself a fabulous day.
Thank you. I will.